Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
My name is still Margaret Ann, and I am still a very grateful recovered compulsive overeater.
Hi.
Hi. Recovered, not cured. I have a fatal disease, a fatal and progressive disease that is held in remission. So I have a daily reprieve condition on my maintenance of spiritual condition by following a few simple guidelines. Simple, not necessarily easy, but I hope you like today's banner. I got this off of Facebook. I got all the good stuff from Facebook. I don't remember exactly what the quote was, but it went something like, I used to think that I was a body that had a soul. Now I know that I am a soul that lives in a body. And I guess, to me, what the recovery part about is where eventually I don't even really think of myself as having these three sections, but everything becomes integrated. So that, is there anybody else here who has lived their life kind of as a head riding around on this body, this thing? Yeah. I really spent a lot of my life in my head, between my ears, profoundly disconnected from my physical being. And the connection that I did have really felt like we were at odds a lot of the time. So, love that silent breakfast thing, yeah?
Yes.
Okay, hate that silent breakfast thing?
Yeah.
Okay, great, yeah. All right, thank you for the honesty, because I have done this. I was introduced to it at a workshop, not a full retreat, but a day-long workshop when we were given this as a lunch thing. So some of us went into a room and ate our brown bag lunch together with this exercise. And I've now done it, you know, maybe a dozen times, I'd say, something like that. I mean, this is not the only times that I've eaten meals in silence. I have gone on long-term meditation retreats. I mean, for me, long-term, a week, 9 days, where you do absolutely everything in silence, and you don't even, like, look to somebody to pass the salt. You maintain complete and total inner silence. And what you find from that is how much noise there is between the ears. It's just looks like after a few days, you have these wonderful, precious moments where, like every other day, you have an interview. Usually, it's either in a group where you all meet with one of the teachers, or one-on-one. And I remember one year, it was probably my second or third silent retreat, and I went into the interview, and when it came around to me, all I said was, make it stop! Because it was just, la, 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 la. And at mealtime, it had a particular tenor to it, though it was going all the time. And at mealtime, it had a particular repetitive pattern. And a lot of it centered on what I was actually eating. A lot of it centered on what I thought other people were thinking about what I was eating, what I thought about what other people were eating. If I scraped my chair too loudly, were they mad at me? Blah, 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 blah. So I overheard many people voicing experiences that I have myself. I eat breakfast almost every morning with my husband with the radio on and the newspaper, so that I can be as profoundly disconnected from my eating as possible, because I find it very, very difficult to do one thing at a time. Now think about the human animal. Okay, our species has been around for, you know, what, 20, 30,000 years that there's been this thing that they identify as Homo sapiens or whatever. How long has this animal been able to eat meals with this kind of distraction? Less than 100 years? Fewer than 100 years? 100 years ago, in the year 1910, there was no TV playing. You probably didn't have a daily newspaper. You might have had some tumult from other people in the house. But that was 100 years ago. Go back 200 years, 300 years, 1,000 years. So this animal has now become acclimated to distraction. Why? Why do I want so much not to attend to this sacred part of my life the feeding of my body. I have an eating disorder. And isn't this an indication of what's disordered about my eating, that I don't even want to be there while I'm doing it? This thing that I crave to do more than anything else? This is my experience. And I save my sheets so that every so often I can compare them. Some things are kind of always the same. Some things differ. But one thing is almost always present, which is the instruction to inventory how full do I feel. Now, this morning I put too much oatmeal in my bowl, and I suspected that when I sat down because I didn't measure it. Normally I measure it dry and then cook it. So that gives me license to put more in my bowl. But this morning when I was 15 minutes into the meal, I realized that I was not going to, that, let me just say, to finish my bowl would be overeating, that I was going to cross the line from feeding my body into feeding my disease. And I was really, and I'm not going to say I was really angry, because I can remember times that I've done this exercise that I really felt angry at that point. I was peeved. And so I had a few more bites, and then I came to that point where, okay, this next bite is the last bite. And there was a little tug of war, and then there was surrender. And you know what? As I sat there in silence for a moment, I realized, now I feel full. No questions asked. I don't feel overfull, but I am full. I have had enough to eat. That doesn't happen as clearly or as often, because I don't eat meals like that. Now, I don't weigh and measure every single meal, and I think with the progression of recovery, for example, when I am eating out or eating a meal that's not measured, I eat more consciously, and I am more conscious of where that point is between feeding my body and feeding my disease, but not consistently enough that I don't still welcome the structure of weighing and measuring my meals. Or, you know, I don't weigh my eggs. I don't weigh my my bananas. I try to buy them within a particular size range, and depending how spiritually fit I am, we have a joke, me and my good program friend Judy, she has what she calls a spiritual apple. You know what a spiritual apple. It's that one that you look at that looks kind of small. Those are spiritual apples. Then we have out west, I don't know if you have them here, we have a kind that you only get around this time of year called a mutsu. They're that big. They're as big as your head. And it was a big deal for me when a few years, I don't even buy them anymore, they're too big. But it was a big deal when I started becoming willing to cut them in half. Because I was like, that's an apple. That's an apple. 7 pounds of apple is one apple. And I was a happy girl. They had a saying in some meetings that I used to go to. If you're feeling spiritually shaky, if you feel like your food's maybe getting a little shaky, they said, you know, double up on meetings and buy the biggest fruit you can find. You know, just keep it simple. But I don't do that anymore. All right. So it's not a mistake that this exercise comes from an eating disorders treatment unit. That's where the person who gave it to me, that's where they got it. Because this is the sort of thing that they do when they treat eating disorders. They take the disordered eater and they make them eat and do nothing else, but actually have a meal where they are alone with their food. And what you find often is it's you, the food, and your disease. And then when you do it in the context of a retreat, you find that God also has a seat at the table, and soon God gets included in that grouping as well. So for me, it's both. It's both trying and rewarding. So I do it willingly every time. I don't necessarily do it wantingly, but that's why I bring it on retreat, because I figure we could all spare one meal for just for us, the nourishment that God is providing for us, and, you know, the spirit that it joins us all. And then at lunchtime, we'll just go back to, you know, shoveling it in heedlessly and talking. And it'll be great. The other thing that I find very useful, which is slowly, I eat a lot faster than my husband, and I resent it terribly. So every so often, I try to pace myself to him by putting the fork down, but that's a difficult practice for me. Okay, so this idea of bringing ourselves into integrity, into partnership with our with all of our being, so that our body is not something separate from us, I think really is at the center of the program. There's a wonderful passage in step one of the OA 12 and 12. This, when I first read this, this is on page 4 of the OA 12 and 12 in step one. At the bottom of the of page 4, when I first read this, when this book first came out, and I was, it came out the first year I joined program, and at that point I had read other literature, I'd read our pamphlets, I'd read the book Overeaters Anonymous, I had read the AA Big Book, and I'd seen the AA Step Book, but this was the first time that I felt like I was nailed, you know, like the old kind of Keystone Cop thing, the person's escaping prison, and then all of a sudden they're against the wall and the spotlight hits them and they're caught. I felt like I was caught in the spotlight when I read this paragraph. Many of us believe that our lives would be manageable if only others around us would do as we wanted. We thought everything would be fine if only our bosses would recognize our worth, if only our spouses would give us the attention we needed, if only our children were well-behaved, if only our parents would leave us alone. Our lives became unmanageable when the car wouldn't start, the computer broke down, or our checking account wouldn't balance. We suffered from other people's unmanaged lives, or from bad luck. What alternative did we have? We ate to sate the fears, the anxieties, the angers, the disappointments. We ate to escape the pressures of our problems or the boredom of everyday life. We procrastinated, we hid, and we ate. That last sentence, there I was, pinned up like a bug against the display board. Here we have genus compulsive vivarus overeaterus. Here she is. Procrastinate, hide, eat. Absolutely nothing in this paragraph has to do with nourishing the body. Nothing. It all has to do with feeding the disease. In step three, on page 20, another paragraph that I think spells out, okay, so up to this point, I have had plenty of structured food plans. I have gotten them out of books. They have been given to me by doctors. I have seen them on television. They've been passed around my office in Xerox sheets. Did anybody get that Xerox sheet that had the cabbage soup? Yeah. The seven grapefruit? Okay, yeah. Banana. Yeah, the bananas, right. They came in a book written by a doctor who got murdered by his lover. Remember that one? Yeah. I was given to them after I'd paid hundreds of dollars to a club. Not a single one of them worked, not one. So I came into Overeaters Anonymous, and I was told, those will never work for you if you're a compulsive overeater because they do not address what your problem is. Your problem is not that you can't control your eating. The truth is, you can't control your eating, but you're not going to find the perfect number of words on a page, numbers on a scale, grams on a cup, whatever, that's going to solve your problem for you. No doctor is going to be able to fix it for you. There is not going to be a surgery or a pill or a therapy that's going to work for you. You are doomed. You're hopeless. None of that is ever going to work for you. It might work for other people who don't have your problem, but for somebody with your problem, they don't work. Not only that, but your problem is going to kill you eventually. If it doesn't physically kill you, it will probably cripple you, but it will certainly make you wish you were dead or somebody else. Okay, that's bad news. And then And then soon after that, I hear people talking about a food plan. And what are they doing? They are planning. They are buying. They are preparing. They are wearing and measuring. I'm like, whoa, hey, I thought you said this wasn't a diet club. And they started talking about doing this as a spiritual practice. Whoa. So this is a wonderful paragraph that I think helps us. And at first reading, if you're really new, this really might still not quite cut it. But I think there's something about the willingness to keep at it that will help this to make more sense. Makes sense to me today anyway. Start on the top of page 20. Our new way of life begins with a willingness to adopt a whole new attitude about weight control, body image, and eating. Our 12-step program is the most important way OA differs from the diet and weight loss programs we tried in the past. Those systems gave us diets to follow, but made us responsible for adhering to them. How did they do that? They gave us a book to fill out. We came in every week. We weighed in. Or we had a buddy or something like that. I don't know if they had this thing in Massachusetts. They had this thing called TOPS. Take off pounds sensibly. Okay, yeah. There, if you didn't take off weight or if you put it on during the week, they made you wear a pig's nose throughout the meeting. Which was all supposed to be in great fun, you know. I don't think most of the people that I've ever heard of that went to TOPS found it to be very much fun. But in that sense, they made you responsible for following them. In OA, we are given no diets. And my understanding of a diet is something that you do for a little while until you've reached what you think is the goal, and then you stop doing it. Mm-hmm. Weight loss is not our only goal, and we accept that even a perfect body, if there were such a thing, would not make us happy. Our primary purpose is to abstain from eating compulsively, and we know that in order to do so, we will need help. So the difference is, in this case, the food plan is physically intended to give us guidance in our choices of eating so as, first off, to eliminate those substances to which we have a sensitivity. And here you get into a lot of controversy because this is an individual thing. I am sensitive to all refined carbohydrates. I read labels, and sugar has to be the fifth ingredient or below, or I do not purchase it. And for the most part, I try not even to have sugar anywhere on the label, but in tiny quantities, it seems to be okay. For many, many years, I did not eat any flour products at all, and I will say that I do eat them now. But again, there's my red foods, my orange foods, which are, caution boundaries around this. If I find that I'm finding excuses to eat them every day or work them into three meals, we know that there's a problem. And then there's my, what I'd say, green foods, the ones that do not seem to touch off the compulsion to overeat. They don't seem to set off craving. Some of the ways that I can recognize the foods that trigger me are they will give me a headache eventually. Sugar, these days, if there's sugar in a food, it will give me a headache. It will. They will also cause anxiety and fear. Within 24 hours of ingesting these foods, I will find myself in an anxious state. They'll make me lethargic. And the next thing is that they will lead me to cravings. And the next thing you know, I might not crave that exact food, but I will be craving more food. I will be craving something. I will be hungry in between meals. And so that's what I can tell. But I think everybody really is an individual. I know many people in this program who are maintaining a recovered body, meaning that they no longer overeat. They're in a healthy body, at a healthy body size. Mentally, they are no longer obsessed with food. Spiritually, they are able to live without fear and in a generous way. And they eat foods that I can't eat at all. But they have found their way through the spiritual surrender to a food plan that works for them. So I would never tell anybody what to eat. I do not tell my sponsees what to eat. I will work with them. But if they are telling me what they're eating and they cannot put together more than a couple of days of abstinence, I will ask them, what is it you're not willing to let go of? What if you gave it a try? What if you abstained from that food today? And if there are foods that I'm really not willing to let go, I know they've got my hooks in me, and they have become my higher power. I'm giving them that power. I will not let this go. I'm not willing to let this go. I am so grateful that God has not yet seen it necessary to take my bananas. But I really trust. I have surrendered things that I really didn't want to, and I have faith that if someday, you know, a doctor tells me, or I just find myself just going bananas over bananas, that I will be able to surrender them. But not today. I had one. It was great. So essentially, though, we know we have to do things that we don't want to do. We have to recognize what the problem is. The problem is not the weight. That's a symptom. The problem really almost isn't even the overeating, but sometimes we have to put the food down in order to see what the problem really is. Because for many of us, once the food is down, there's a great release. I'm no longer obsessed with food. I'm no longer craving. After I'd been off sugar for a week, I found a miraculous release from craving for it. And now it's been a long time, and I feel so much peace around certain foods. I can have them in my house. I can have them around me. I can even prepare them at times. And I am completely released from the desire or the need to put them in my mouth. Where was I going with that? Yeah, okay, so all right, great, okay, good. Thank you. Thank you so much. So the problem is not with the food, but so that's gone. I'm no longer obsessed about food, but then other things start coming up. Oh my goodness, I'm fearful. I'm always wanting some comfort. I'm feeling anxious. I'm feeling restless, irritable, and discontented. And for me, I had been abstinent for actually a couple years when I started becoming very angry. A lot of anger was coming out. And what I've been told is that when the food goes down, I start a race. And the race is between the steps and the food. I have got to get at the causes and conditions. And what it says in here, our food was but a symptom. So we had to get to the causes and conditions. It's in here somewhere. So first I had to surrender to what the problem really was. And I also even had to surrender to the idea that I didn't maybe necessarily understand what my problem was, but you did. You knew that I was suffering from a spiritual malady. I thought it was physical and mental, but you told me, no, it's actually spiritual. That I am blocked from the sunlight of the spirit. I am blocked from the source of power, not just to keep the food bound down, but to handle everything in my life. And once that is straightened out, once I've gained access to that power, which I call God, then I will straighten out mentally and physically as well. So I could not recover until I was willing to do things that I did not want to do and to do things that I didn't think that I could do. And the thinking really was the problem. I think if the literature, if the big book and OA literature had been written, especially the big book had been written in a time when computers were more in use, that he probably would have used the computer metaphor. So if you've ever had a computer where there's a hard drive error, for example, no matter what you put into it, the result, what it does with the information, is going to be wrong. And it's not even garbage in, garbage out. It's data in, garbage out, because there is a flaw in the operating system. At that point, if you've worked with computers, you have to feed it new software because it can't tell you what's wrong with it. It's flawed. And that's the same thing with my mind. My mind cannot tell me what's wrong with my mind because it's flawed, you see. I can't fix my thinking with my thinking. Self cannot reveal self to self. So with a computer, you get a diagnostic disc or something like that. You give it a new brain temporarily that will help it to find where the problems are, correct them, replace them, and start anew. So that means that when I come in here, I must accept the fact that I really don't even know what my problem is. That's step one. I'm powerless over food. Okay, my long years of eating, dieting, purging, binging, insanity have clued me in. I'm powerless over food. And my life has become unmanageable. That I might, you know, have many interpretations, but I think that paragraph about, you know, what we did when the computer broke down, the check would have been balanced, so on and so forth, I think that reveals it. That when I came in here, it wasn't just my eating and my weight. There were problems in every part of my life that I was eating over. The further problem is that I am not going to be able to make up my mind to fix him. Even if you show me, well, okay, you're fearful, and you're controlling, and you're a people pleaser, and oh, okay, I hear people sharing about that in meetings. Oh, I see. The further problem is that I can't just make up my mind, okay, now I'm going to be different. That's not going to work. I need the diagnostic disc, and that is the steps. So step one is simply recognizing that I am insane, that this is not right. A lot of people get hung up on step two, which says, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Step two is not the one about accepting the insanity. Step one is. So step one, I'm off in the ditch. I can't fix this by myself. I don't even really understand what my problem is. I just have to understand that if I'm one of you, I have a fatal progressive disease. And it is spiritual in nature, characterized by distortion in thinking and an abnormal sensitivity of the body. So I have a spiritual malady. My spirit is sick. I'm blocked off from the source of power, which is God, spirit, universe, whatever you want to call it. But I'm blocked off from this power that is greater than my abilities. My mind is not reliable. It has become twisted by this disease. And my body is sickened as well. It has an abnormal sensitivity, an abnormal reaction to food. Okay. Step two, hopefully, is apparent to everybody who walks into an OA meeting and hears person after person saying, I've been in this program for 2 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. Hopefully, they are hearing people say, and I have been free of compulsive overeating for X amount of time. Or at least they're hearing that people keep coming back because they believe that something's here. Not everybody's lucky enough to go to a meeting in a community where there's a lot of people with abstinence who can support in that. But at least we can support each other because we recognize that there is a solution here. Step two simply means I believe that there is a solution. I have no freaking idea what it is. So step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. So it's not even coming to believe in God. Step two does not require us to believe in God. It simply asks us to be open to the notion that there could be something outside us that will work for us. And the evidence that I have for that is that you tell me it's worked for you and you have no reason to lie to me because you're not trying to sell me anything. That's it. Step three, I'm going to surrender to the solution that you tell me to pursue. I'm going to do what you tell me to. I'm going to do a lot of stuff that I don't think makes sense and that I don't want to do because I'm desperate. I've given up. So that means that I'm going to have to change my thinking. I'm going to have to allow my thinking to be changed because if I always do what I've always done, finish the quote, I'll always get what I always got. And it's my thinking that brings me into this. So I have lived on self-will. I have lived on self-reliance. I have done what I think is going to work next, and it has not worked. So my eating disorder, I do not believe, is a mistake. My abnormal relationship with food is how God has brought me closer to God. So today, I am able to say that I'm grateful to be a compulsive overeater in Food Act, because it has given me access to a source of power that doesn't just heal my body, but it has healed every area of my life. But it took a while to get to that. So there's a beautiful passage in the Bible or something like that. It says that we are made stronger in our broken places. And then there's a Leonard Cohen song where he says, you know, the crack is where the sunlight shines through, or something, the light shines through. I love those images, the idea that our flaw is actually our greatest asset, because it gets our attention. Plenty of people can just go through life going on self-will. Sometimes it's not a problem. Sometimes it's a terrible problem. For us, it was a failure. It didn't work. So in order to recover from this disease, we have to straighten out spiritually, mentally, and physically. And if you told me when I got here that all I was going to get was 80 pounds of lasting weight loss and the feeling that I was not deprived and that it wasn't going to really cost me anything more than a few bucks that I'm voluntarily giving, I would have said, sign me up. That's the best deal I've ever heard. But, you know, like many others in this room, I think a lot of you could raise your hands and say, you know, that was the least of it from of what is available through this recovery process. But it started from a willingness to change my thinking, to admit that my thinking is not reliable, and that if I do these actions, if I will act, I will act my way into right thinking. I cannot think my way into right action. So I became willing to take direction. So right now, from wherever you are in your course of life, your thinking may have told you certain messages about your body. So what I'd like to do now is just take about 10 minutes to write some of those messages, some of those painful messages, some of those harmful messages that you have heard in your mind about your body, or that you have heard from other people, or that you think other people are thinking about you and your body. All the things that you think really are your disease talking about your body, just put them on a separate sheet of paper. This, you're going to give this sheet of paper away, okay? So start a fresh new sheet of paper. And if I were going to write mine, you know, it might say things like, you're weak, you're a slob. I no longer really hear these messages very much, but these are the messages that I told myself about my body. You're fat, you're not attractive, you're slow, you're clumsy. Anything about your body that doesn't serve, write them on a piece of paper. Or things that you think your body can't do. Just take about 10 minutes just to write those messages, and you're going to let them go. So write them on a fresh piece of paper that you're going to tear out of your book, and I'm going to collect them. could be different body parts. Are there particular body parts that you have certain beliefs about, or you think other people have beliefs about, you've been told about, that are hurtful or harmful? As soon as you feel like you've kind of got everything out onto that piece of paper, crumple it up, raise your hand, and I will come and collect it in this box. I'm not going to look at anything. Don't rush, though. Keep going if you... And now let's take a break until about 10:30 so you can get coffee, stretch a little bit, get some fresh air. Thank you. So I've got a box full of crumpled papers in there. I put one in there myself, thinking, yeah, I wonder what's going to come out. And there were several very limiting beliefs that I found as I wrote. So I'm really happy to turn them over. Anybody else have any still? We're going to burn them. We're going to have a great big bonfire tonight. We're going to be burning several things tonight. So that'll be great to get it started. So I've heard several things that I think really sum up my distorted sense of self. I'm sure you've heard this one. I believed I was the piece of crap around which the world revolved. And the first time I heard that, that was also another pin to the board moment of really identifying with that low self-worth, that feeling of myself as being inferior and wrong and bad, and then also seeing myself as the center of things. When I first came into this program and saw this idea of selfishness and self-centeredness, of course, I did not think of myself as a self-centered person, even in the slightest. I had a very good friend back when I was active. She was an eating buddy. She was also extremely obese. And so we got together to feed our diseases. And we became estranged. And I later learned, or she accused me of being very self-centered. And honest to God, I felt as unjustly accused as if she had accused me of stealing her car, which I could prove with video evidence I had never done. I genuinely had no idea what she was talking about. And over the years, it took me several years in Overeaters Anonymous to see exactly what she was talking about. The ways in which, for example, if we were, and she and I were both on a similar kind of career path. We were both trying to work as performers in Boston. Everything that she did, I made about me, as if that was the most natural thing in the world. Because I genuinely saw the universe as being Margot-centric. To me, there was nothing unusual about that because I didn't know that I wasn't the center of everything. I really didn't. Really, really didn't. Thought I was kind, generous, friendly, helpful, cooperative, a good employee. But this is another great thing that I heard somebody say. They said, I always thought I was a people pleaser, and then I realized that I didn't give a shit if you were pleased or not. I just wanted you to like me. Oh my God. Yes. That's me. I had no idea. I really thought that I was seeing the truth. I really believed that I was seeing things as they were. And it never would have been possible. And now I'm not saying, and now I see everything exactly as it is. But what I know is that my view of things has changed. Just like it said in the OA 12 and 12, I became willing to adopt a whole new attitude about everything, not just weight control, body image, and eating. I really became willing to let go of my old ideas about everything. And I found out some of my old ideas turned out to be sound, that it is good to be kind and generous to people, that I still believe. What isn't good, helpful, or selfless is to be kind and generous to people at the expense of my own health. That is ego. That is inflated self-esteem, actually. It is not kind, generous, or God-conscious. It is not an act of selflessness to be kind and generous at the expense of my own well-being. Now, sometimes it might be at the expense of my own comfort, but you know what? I can be uncomfortable and still be in a perfect state of well-being. But if I am working so hard that I'm starving my body of the rest that it needs, if I am accepting offers of food that is toxic to my body because I do not want to offend you, if I am skipping meetings because I have to do something for you, because a spouse, a friend, a family member, a child says, I want you here, don't go to your meeting. That is not kindness or generosity. Now, if I'm going out to meetings 7 days a week because I want to get out of the house, okay, that's a different story. But if I am not treating myself and if I am not participating in the solution to my disease, then I'm not helping anybody. Has anybody ever had a that kind of moment of shock still when you hear the thing about put the oxygen mask on your own face before you put it on the kids? That's what we're talking about. That's humility. That's humility. If I am in a place of fatigue, starvation, toxicity, whatever it is, because I think I need to take care of you, that is not selfless service. That is selfish service. Because at that point, I have moved out of my right relationship. I have actually started now playing God. Because I think that I can determine what I'm, even though I know better, even though I know I need to take care of myself, I at that point are going, no, I'll be okay, because I'm going to do for you. Why am I doing that? So that you'll like me, or so that you won't yell or nag or scream or tantrum or something like that, basically so that I'll feel comfortable. And I'm willing to starve myself or keep myself awake or stay at work later because I don't want you to get mad. That's not taking care of you. That's basically taking care of myself. So it all comes back to that. So I was willing to either, you know, starve myself or binge and starve myself of needed nutrients. I was willing to run myself ragged rather than risk you disliking me or not thinking that I was God, you know, just the best thing ever. You are the most valuable employee we've ever had here. That's what I wanted you to think of me. You are my favorite child. That's what I wanted you to think of me. You're the best student. That's what I wanted you to think of me. That's not humility. That's status seeking. That's the ego feeding itself. That is when the self becomes a prison. That's the bondage of self. Another great thing that I heard was, who do you, don't you know who I think I am? Yeah. So this sense of self was something that I constructed. I constructed it from my past, you know, the story that I told myself, and I had the story of poor little orphan Margaret from her poor little orphan parents. I also then had the story of what I was going to be someday, my ambitions. Someday I'm essentially going to be queen of the universe and or something glorious. And what never was really getting told was the story of who I actually was. Integrated body, mind, and spirit. So the present moment was always starved while I was living in who I thought I was based on who I had been and what had happened to me and who I was someday going to be. Your favorite, the best, the queen, the top of it all. And in between, what got completely left out was who I am right now, right here, right now. I thought I could control all of that. I could control how you saw me. I could control how you reacted to me. And this really seemed natural to me. So when I was behaving in this way that my friend correctly perceived as selfishness, I couldn't see it. Try to ask a fish to explain water. What do you mean? It's all there is. You ever try to explain air to a very small child? The idea that there actually is something there? It takes a little while to grasp that. And, you know, to this day, it's still a little difficult to believe that there's actually substance all around me. So my methods of control then were several, and they were mostly mental. So my mind came up with strategies that then my body could carry out. So there were the ones to make me feel good. Okay. Eating was a big part of that. Sleeping was a big part of that. Things like that. Things that brought the body pleasure and a sense of calm. And eating did that for a long time. And then even after it stopped doing that consistently, it would still do it for short periods of time. So I could have a little bit of pleasure as I sat down to a big plate or bowl or box or bag of X. Then there would be no pleasure halfway through it. There would be no pleasure when it was gone. And then there would be a moment's calm as I got the next container of X. But that was one thing I had that I was able to do. And then a big part of it was manipulating your attitude towards me. So since I was already so afraid of what you thought about me because I was overweight, I had to find other ways of getting you to have a good opinion of me. And of course, there was being the teacher's pet. I'll be absolutely the most adorable thing you've ever seen. There was being funny. There was being your best friend. This came in. Now, the whole manipulation to get stuff, I really learned that at an early age. Every little kid knows how to behave to get, cookies, basically. You know the strategies. You can use a lot of manipulations. You can be adorable to do it. You can be sad to do it. Well, I'll tell you, when my father had a massive stroke when I was 9 years old, it was devastating. But what I learned was people will give you food even if you're fat when your dad's in the hospital. Mm-hmm. That doesn't sound very attractive, does it? But that's what I learned at the age of 9. They feel bad for you. And so even though they know they shouldn't be giving more calories to the fat kid, they will, because they know it'll make the fat kid happy. Mm-hmm. And it worked. So then years later, when I was in middle school and high school, I used the same sorts of tactics to get people to give me drugs. Drugs that I couldn't afford to buy on my own, I would just get them to give me drugs. Years later, I would use the same tactics to get people to give me compliments or to give me praise. Sometimes maybe I would be in competition with somebody else, and maybe I would use a combination of guilt or wheedling or, being funny or, promising to clean out your garage. I didn't clean anybody's garage, but all these different manipulations to get the result that I wanted from the person by manipulating their emotions. So that meant I became very good at reading people's emotions, taking note of people's emotions, and then what starts happening, I think I control people's emotions. And now I think I am responsible for people's emotions. Anybody heard that much misused word, boundaries? Okay, I hear it used around a lot as being, well, I have to set boundaries, meaning, I'm not going to drive you to soccer practice every day this week or something like that. No, boundaries actually, when they started using, I think, in therapeutic circles, it meant the fact that I didn't understand where I ended and you began. I became an emotional sponge, completely controlled by other people's emotional states. And this added to my distortion of self. I didn't understand who I was in relation to you. I was the piece of crap around which the world revolved. I knew in my heart of hearts how defective I really was. And yet, at the same time, I thought I was responsible for everything and that I could control everything. So this is like juggling plates, right? You ever seen the guy with all the different poles and he just keeps them all spinning? Does anybody identify with that sort of thing? Yeah. That's self-reliance. That's when I come to a belief that I am capable of keeping all the plates in motion. And I really believe that if I just manage, I'm going to be able to get everything to come out right. And this is identified in the big book as our problem. We read How It Works this morning. How It Works is followed by the 12 steps. Now, How It Works is, it's very important to understand everything that comes before How It Works, because before you're really ready to accept the program of action, you have to know what your problem is. And so I had to recognize that my problem was this abnormality, this spiritual malady coupled with this abnormality of the mind and the abnormality of the body. So it says right underneath, on page 60, right underneath the last of the 12 steps, it says, okay, whoa, 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 don't worry, you know, it's, you can do this, because it says many of us exclaim, what an order, I can't go through this. So immediately it recognizes, yeah, this is drastic. But before you get to this chapter, hopefully you have been convinced that you really are up against it, that your situation is so dire that only a drastic course of action such as this is going to do it. And it states it again. It says, our description of the alcoholic, the compulsive overeater, the chapter to the agnostic, so the, you know, the caution and the comfort to those of you who are worried that this God thing isn't going to work for you, and our personal adventures before and after makes clear three pertinent ideas: that we were compulsive overeaters and could not manage our own lives. And so hopefully we have come on to understand what compulsive overeater really means, or compulsive eater, compulsive undereater, food addict. It means we are doomed. This is not going to get better. It's only going to get worse, and it's going to take us right to the end. And there's no way out. No solution is going to work. That probably no human power could have relieved our compulsive eating. So right, it says right there, you're not going to find the magic selection, the magic combination of surgeon's pills, crystals, chanting, therapies, and past life regression that's going to do this for you. That God could and would if he were sought. That, there it is, step two. That there is a power that can resolve this problem. Being convinced, so we're convinced of this. I'm screwed, there's a solution. That's it. I'm screwed, there's a solution. We were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood him, which in many cases people read as God as we misunderstood him or God or it or whatever. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And in many circles, will is simply defined as thinking. Thinking. Our will is our thinking. So our self-will, our own thinking that emanates from our great and powerful minds, if that's what's in charge of our life, it can hardly be a success. And then it goes on to say, just like so many of us, you know, that on this basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. So the rest of this next couple of pages talks about the problems that come from self, from this limited idea of who we are and what we really our Buddha basically had been put into this body to do. So we came in here, we knew that we couldn't stop eating or we couldn't start eating if our problem was that we were starving ourselves, or we couldn't stop getting rid of the food once we'd put it into our bodies. We couldn't stop thinking about food. We knew that we're done with that. We're done trying to control it ourselves. Next, we're told it's not even just the food, it's everything. And that is going to require surrender. So step one is just essentially, I give up. I'm going to stop trying to control my food. I'm going to give control of food over to this higher power. And for many of us, the first manifestation of our higher power, as in terms of food, is our sponsor. And she's going to help us to work out a way that we will eat. And in my area, that usually means you're going to call her every day at an ungodly hour of the morning, and you're going to tell her exactly what you're going to eat that day. Fun times. You're actually going to take the time to plan and prepare your meals and to, that's how most people do it in my area. And that's really the commencement, I think, of step three is I'm going to start taking directions. I can't, God can, I think I'll let God. And the first aspect of God, and I'm not going to keep fighting against this God thing. Whatever my concept of it, if it's not been working for me, I'm just going to let it go. And I'm going to stop struggling with my ideas of what God isn't. I'm even going to stop struggling against the word God, if that is a problem for me. I'm simply going to move forward in the belief that you people aren't lying to me. And now the idea is that by surrendering my thinking, I'm also going to make a decision to surrender my life, my actions, and all outcomes. So will thinking, life actions, and outcomes. And the shorthand I've heard about that is, the rest of my life is none of my business. So the next question, well, then whose business is it? Believe it's God's. And that's what we know, those of us especially who've been around for a while, if you read the literature, it talks constantly about knowing, seeking to know and to do God's will. I was terrified when I first came in here because I thought, eventually I'm going to end up, you know, going on a missionary mission to Borneo and I'm never going to have fun again. And that hasn't turned out to be true. And I have to be totally honest, I'm still at odds with what God's will apparently is, because there's still a lot of things that I think I would be happy if I were doing. But those are still, I still have a lot of self-centered ideas. And when I relax into what I actually am doing, things are great, really. I mean, there have been plenty of difficulties over the years, but I really like my life, especially when I can let go of ideas about the way I think it's supposed to be. So, this body image is all tied up with that distorted self-image. If I genuinely see myself in the great, you know, context of the cosmos as the piece of crap around which the world revolves, how am I going to see my body? What expectations am I going to have of my body? What demands am I going to place on it? And then, you know, how am I going to actually treat it? If I'm a continual people pleaser, am I going to allow my body the rest it needs? Am I going to say yes when I mean no? Am I going to go along with what everybody else is going to do, even though I know, for example, it's my meal time? For me, I cannot have more than about 6 hours in between my meals. It doesn't work for me. It just doesn't. I start getting cranky and anxious and tired and all those other things, or overly revved up. It doesn't work. I can't afford it. That might be for other people. You know, this is why I'm not an FBI agent. They apparently, you know, probably don't, can't, not that I ever wanted to be, but in all humility, in recognition of my reality as a recovered compulsive eater, God has put me in a body that requires regular servings of nutritious food. I just can't go for 10 hours without eating. So do I place that demand on my body because I think it's more important to do X? Do I not oh, I don't know. There's so many things. But the things that I'd like us to look at now, and we're going to take, I'd say, about 20 minutes. This should take about 20 minutes, but maybe it won't. But I'd like to give time for it. We're going to write a couple of letters. So if you're, especially if you're like me, you have had this idea of a separation between your head and your body. For many years, my body was more of an enemy than a friend, really. And if it had been able to speak to me, I think it might have said things like, I've really been trying to keep up. I've been trying to support you. I've been trying to make use of the food that you've given me. Some of it I have to store as fat because I have no place else to put it. Or, you know, you have pounded me so unmercifully with over-exercise that, you know, my cartilage is going now, but I'm going to try to keep moving you along. My body might say, I can't move as fast as you want me to sometimes because, you know, the years and the excess pounds have taken their toll. That's, you know, that's something that I live with today. I went to a doctor complaining of pains in my knees, and I was pretty sure it had to do with arthritis, among other things. And before he ran the x-rays, he said, well, it's very unlikely that somebody of your age would have significant arthritis, until he got back the x-rays. And he said, wow, we don't usually see this in somebody who hasn't been, you know, a professional mountain climber, much older, or has been extremely overweight. And I said, well, doctor, I was for many years. And there it was. And that's not going away. So that was one thing that my body might have told me. My body might ask me to really be sure not to go too long without meals. My body might tell me that it doesn't like it when I stay up too late and then ask it to get up really early in the morning. My body might say, you know, maybe 5 cups of coffee and followed by 3 Diet Cokes is not the best thing for me. And I'm not saying, you know, recently my body told me that I had to switch to decaffeinated coffee. I had 1 cup of caffeinated this morning, and next thing I knew I was speeding my tits off, but I've calmed down a little bit, but it was good. It was really good coffee. Yeah, so that was something that my body said, you know, even if you want the caffeinated coffee, maybe you should wait for the decaf, even if you don't like it as much. So the first thing we're going to do is going to write a letter from our body to us. And we might start with some statements. I don't like it when mine might say, you stay up too late, or you you ask me to use caffeine instead of rest, or you say yes when you mean no, or you accept, you know, you eat with everybody else instead of eating your planned meal. I'm sad that you feel so bad about me. I'm sad that I can't be what you want me to be. Whatever your body might feel sad about. And then this is what I want for you, for us. This is what my body wants for me. So this is a letter from your body to you. Yes? No, this is for you. This is for you. Nothing ever gets turned in, and nothing gets shared unless you want to share it. This is entirely between your body and you. This is all one letter. These are just statements that you might use to start the sentences. I don't like it when you do this. I'm sad that. This is what I want for you. So this is all one letter from your body to you. And we'll just take probably a little over 5 minutes to write this, because then there's going to be another letter. But this you don't need to tear out. This you can keep, do with as you please. Okay. So continue writing if you're still writing. But there's another letter, and now you get to write back to your body. And what I did was I simply sat down and tried to allow my mind to come to rest and see what happened. I tried to see what came out, sometimes even asking God what the words should be. What would I say to my body in a letter? And some of the sentences might start out with, "I'm sorry that." And then, what I need God's help to do so that I can live in healthful partnership with my body. So it might be, "I'm sorry that." I need God's help so that I can get more rest. Say no when I mean no. Whatever it is. Buy the broccoli. Use the Tupperware that I bought last week. Whatever it is. So it's making a sincere amends for anything that I need to make amends for. And then recognizing the spiritual source of power that will enable me to make any changes that I need to make those amends to my body. So rather than writing a list of I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that, in this letter, recognize that God is the source of power to help you to do these things. So that's the next letter. And we'll do that until about 11:25. Then we're going to have time for sharing.